devastating floods across South Asia.
It's Hurricane Harvey on its path of destruction.
With the latest on Hurricane Irma.
And this is the scene across Mexico City.
And this is the scene in Puerto Rico right now. A powerful Category 4 storm. Maria is...
This is Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. It's been a turbulent few months. Natural disasters are wreaking havoc everywhere. Just as the U.S. has been beset by a string of powerful hurricanes, Bangladesh is experiencing some of the worst monsoons ever, with an estimated one-third of the country underwater, more than 1,000 dead, and as many as 41 million people displaced or affected by the floods. Earlier this month, Mexico endured its own crisis, a succession of powerful earthquakes that have killed more than 300 people and left thousands homeless. And now it may be Bali's turn. A week has gone by since the island was placed on high alert. Just east from here, a 3,000-meter high volcano is set to erupt. Thousands of tremors have been recorded in recent days, indicators that within Mount Agung, the pressure builds and the magma rises. I'm recording this from my home, just 35 kilometers west of the mountain. As of this moment, close to 50,000 people have been evacuated outside of a 12-kilometer perimeter. Agung is just one of 120 volcanoes that comprise the so-called Ring of Fire in the Indonesian archipelago. The degree to which Agung's activity is interrelated with the other volcanoes in the region isn't entirely understood. In fact, it remains a bit of a mystery. This brings me to the topic of this week's episode, which eerily addresses the aftermath of the 2011 tsunami in Fukushima, Japan. You'll hear about how one individual joined the recovery effort to discover what human endurance really looks like. He also learned something about his adopted country and the people of Japan. It's the second part of my interview with Kent Wertheim, co-CEO of Ogilvy & Mather Asia Pacific. For those of you who haven't listened to the first part of my interview with Kent, he's a thought leader on the impact and implications of digital content and marketing. In the first part of our conversation, we focused on the role Asia has played in innovating, tweaking, and adopting digital and mobile services and technologies. Kent talked about what he called the stress of communication, the way that today we're continually deluged with news and advertisements, Facebook posts and tweets, all demanding our immediate attention. Kent told me in the course of our discussion that corporations generally act ethically and represent accurately the products and services they back. They are less adept at determining the best means of penetrating the wall of information that greets consumers at every minute of every day. It's a matter of information overload, and branding today simply doesn't resonate the way it once did. The time has come for corporations to rethink the meaning of marketing. Here's Kent from our earlier episode.
The truth is agencies are paid to sell clients' products. So, you know, we obviously have an obligation, a legal obligation, not to do anything incorrect. We have a moral obligation not to do anything that generally causes harm. And our obligation is to our client, and those clients as companies that have to be good corporate citizens generally try to follow some guidelines. The reality, though, is we don't wake up every day worrying about social good in general. We wake up worrying about, can we help our clients promote their products? So when you do something for a client, they're looking at the ability to promote and sell their particular product. They're not saying, I'm not going to sell my product today because I worry about, but there's too much information today, so therefore I'm not going to send anything out today. So, I mean, that's an honest and correct lens of the reality of things.
I asked about his experiences around the time of the 2011 tsunami when he was serving as head of Ogilvy's Japan operations. For Kent, it was an event that further shaped his deep and abiding respect for the region and its people. While Asia seemed 25 plus years ago as good a place as any to build a career, his time here has brought him into sync with the people, the culture, and its sensibilities. Nowhere was the character of the region more poetically yet tragically played out than in Fukushima, Japan. There, he saw firsthand the character of the Japanese people as they grappled with the aftermath of one of the region's most destructive tsunamis. I wasn't in Japan at that time, but the event reverberated throughout the region. Many of us living and working in Asia lost friends, offered shelter, and did our best to raise relief funds to support those who suffered the tsunami's devastating effects. The residents of Sanai on Japan's northeast coast suffered the most. But the earthquake that triggered the tsunami was felt 350 kilometers away that day in the Japanese capital of Tokyo. A longtime resident told me that when the quake struck, everyone rushed into the streets and out of buildings. Even in the open, he said, no one felt safe. I stood in amazement, he recalled, as the pavement rippled and curled around us. I didn't think pavement could do that, he said. It forever killed for me the idea of stable ground. Well, let's get back to my interview with Kent. He was living in Japan at the time and running the offices of Ogilvy. Following the destruction, he traveled north in the company of work colleagues, friends, and his son in order to do whatever he could do to help. I asked him about the experience, the things he saw, and what it taught him about the Japanese people.
I actually think it was one of the great blessings so far of my life that I was in Japan at the time of that disaster. It was a secret blessing, and I say that because I was lucky enough to experience directly and witness one of the worst times in a place, which is when you either see the best or the worst of people. So Fukushima was, at the time for Tokyo, the big worry because no one knew for a period of several weeks whether the thing was going to blow or not, and how much radiation had actually been released, what was it doing to the environment, what was it doing to Tokyo. So it was a triple whammy, and you know, the truth is, in a place and at the scale of the earthquake that happened there, it's not just the occurrence of that single earthquake, the aftershocks that hit. Even recently, there was another earthquake where they're still blaming it 5 years later. They're saying that's actually an aftershock of that big, the big one that hit 5+ years ago. And, you know, it was this weird mix of this incredible shake of the earth, the dropping of the seafloor by 20 feet up in Tohoku, the enormous tsunami that literally just consumed entire towns along the coast, and then the hit on Fukushima and the uncertainty that followed. It was a very weird mix of the calamity. I was very lucky, though, in that I was running the agency there and was, you know, responsible for a group of people during that time, and got to see how those people, plus the people around and the people when we went to Tohoku, how they behaved. And it was during that time that I deeply, deeply fell in love with Japan and the Japanese, seeing how they reacted.
And you made a decision that not everyone made, which was to stay behind, because we didn't know at the time whether or not there'd be additional aftershocks. We didn't know what the danger, we didn't know about the, you know, what was going to happen with the nuclear power plants. But you decided to remain and be there for your team and demonstrate to them that this is something that you were going to stay the course and see them through this, which was quite commendable. And then it was several months later then you went up and tried to help with the relief effort. Is that right?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure it was commendable. There were still, you know, 20+ million people in Tokyo at the time who were there. So, you know, there were plenty of people around me. And part of it was a feeling that and there were a lot of foreigners who were choosing to leave. But, you know, I faced a bit of a quandary because I had the staff. We had said to people after the earthquake who were, again, concerned. Nobody knew about Fukushima. That was the main worry at the time. You know, we said to foreigners, you can, you know, if you wish to leave, you can. We will not dock you. You can work remotely. And, you know, the truth is we had to say the same thing to Japanese. There's no point of saying because you're a foreigner, you can flee what is potential harm. But because you're a Japanese, you have to stay. So, you know, you're confronted suddenly with, you know, looking at what is an honest choice. And we said, well, anybody, it's where, even if you're a native of Japan, you don't necessarily have to stay in Tokyo. If you're concerned, you can work remotely too. And so everyone had to make their choice. I personally thought, as long as there's not specific evidence of Fukushima causing serious radiation in Tokyo, I've got colleagues around who are choosing to stay. I felt it was important to be part of that group of people staying and giving it a go. Now, if that had all changed, I equally would have wanted my colleagues to leave at the same time. But I felt it was important to stay and do that.
But then we went to, you know, just watching the reaction of the Japanese and the way they responded to the crisis. I mean, you know, you would see and people were commenting at the time that you might have expected looting or a lot of outbreak of panic and bad responses and social issues, but not at all. In fact, people really gravitated and pulled together in a really refreshing and shockingly beautiful way. I wonder if you could tell us a couple of those stories and what you observed when you saw people.
Yeah, well, I think that's the reason I fell so deeply in love with Japan and respect the Japanese so much, is you don't get to see inside the kimono very often in Japan, and emotionally. And what I saw wasn't politeness. What I saw was goodness. And, you know, it's true that there was the usual anxiety that happens with a disaster, and, you know, people weren't sure if they were going to have problems with water and all of that. But, you know, the Japanese view was you need a bottle of water too. And it wasn't the hoarding or the looting. People were orderly, not just out of sort of rote politeness, but I think out of real decency and out of respect for other people who got to make a go, which is, you know, the best part, I think, of Japanese society. Often it's kind of treated as just a politeness and a formality instead of it being a genuine kind of good character and an understanding that comes from, you know, the many, many, many generations of the Japanese living in such great physical proximity, that you genuinely have to respect that other people have to be able to live and cohabitate in order to have a society. And so I got to see that up close. I also, though, in going up to Tohoku, got to see some just incredible bravery and decency again. I remember we went up on a few different trips. As a company, we decided we were committed to going up, and not people weren't required to go. It was voluntary. And, you know, many of my staff, this is another thing that really touched me. They wished, and they did, they took their personal leave to then go volunteer, to live in a tent, to spend a week mucking out houses, helping out people that had been hit by the incredible disaster. And we went up as a company on a number of trips. And I remember on the second of the trips, when we went to Manami Sanriku, which was literally wiped off the map, just the scale of the tsunami waves that hit there were beyond belief. I remember being at least half a mile inland, and there was not a building under four stories that survived. And I remember being half a mile inland, seeing a four-story building with a car upturned on the roof. That's how big the waves were. And so literally the entire town was wiped out. We mucked out a house around one of the coves where their daughter was one of the true heroines of the day, because she was working in the government office and was on a loudspeaker urging people to flee, even as she was overcome then by the tsunami and lost her life. And there we were basically just moving all the mountains of debris out of their front yard just to have a space to be able to exit the house. And there the parents were inside making the onigiri rice balls for the volunteers, offering them up, serving them to people who were mucking at the house. And these were people that had just lost their daughter. And, you know, just again, the bravery, the decency of how people conduct themselves. They were thankful for the help despite their own grief. And that taught me a lot. It taught my son, who went with me on some of those trips. It taught us very deep lessons. And, as I said, I feel very lucky in a way to have been there during that disaster. I also have this kind of, and this may sound politically incorrect, but it's the honest truth, so I'll say it. I haven't felt that alive in my life before. Just this incredible consciousness and currentness. When you're kind of facing those type of situations, I remember feeling utterly alive. Not that I don't now, but there was a kind of heightened awareness of just what every day brings you and the luck that you have, and the fact that, you know, you can't live with anxieties and fears, because, you know, there are people that face much greater problems and disasters and loss of life, and you just got to embrace it and not be afraid. So, I don't know, I came away from that whole period. It was, you know, it was scary of sorts, but it was, I feel kind of lucky to have experienced that, because it was a very unique time. And not that I wish it on people, not at all, but if you're in it, all you can do is take the lessons from it. And as I said, my lessons were the lessons of seeing people stronger than I was, that I could learn and respect and just kind of, you know, admire the way they approach the calamity.
You know, living as long as you have in Asia, looking back at your Native America, What are some thoughts and considerations you have about what's happening now and what's occurring, and how does it make you feel in terms of your position in the world and your position as an American abroad?
Well, you know, despite having lived more of my life now outside of Asia, outside of America than in America, you know, I'm still an American, I'm still a patriot, still love the place, I love what America stands for, I love what I grew up knowing and believing in. I still hold those values close to me, and they're my DNA. I think my greatest wish for America, living the life I lead, is simply to get more people to open their eyes. America is a great country, but you stay great by understanding the real benchmarks of the world. And, you know, being receptive to the fact that other people have good ideas, being open to other people having sometimes superior ideas. And I think, you know, there's nothing worse than arrogance. It blinds you.
Is it progressive? Is it something that you think has changed over time? You see a higher level of arrogance now than you did when you left many, many years ago?
You know, America, you know, it's natural for people who are patriotic to consider where they live the greatest place on earth. But that doesn't mean that everything about that place is the best decision or the best way it can be done or the best option or even state of the art. And, you know, I know there's a creeping anxiety in America, as evidenced by the recent politics and reactions to various things, that America's fallen behind. So I think there is a sense in America that they've fallen behind. But I think, you know, rather than blaming it on trade or on foreigners, it's about understanding the reshaping that continues to go on in the world, and also being continuously open to new ideas and understanding what other people are doing to get ahead. And it's not just about unfair trade deals. There's, you know, I can tell you, because I'm lucky enough, I travel the region constantly. I'm seeing young Asians all the time who are hardworking, who are going the extra mile to learn new things, who are open to new ideas. And there are plenty of kids in America that are same. But, you know, that it's a global world of competition, and it's not all about unfair competition. Some of it's just about competition. And, you know, the U.S., to be competitive, has to be honest with itself and has to be open and has to have its eyes open to the real state of affairs. And that's not all about an uneven playing field. In fact, it's often about a very even playing field. And, you know, I think America needs to be more competitive, not less, but not the competitiveness needs to not be born out of a sense that it's all unfair.
Yeah, fair enough. Are you concerned for the future of the Asian economy based on some of the, you know, new administration's views on trade and throwing up tariffs against Asian-made products?
Yeah, I think most people are, because America is such an important part of the global trading system. What I'm afraid of, though, is that China is very ready and willing, especially with One Belt, One Road. I mean, it's already got a stated policy of investment in many of the countries around the world, and those that are the one they see as one, you know, kind of priority is One Belt, One Road. They're very happy to fill the void. And, you know, what people can't underestimate is when you create a void, it doesn't necessarily stay unfilled for long. And you say, well, where will it come from? Well, again, you know, there are other big economies now that will, the Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese, the Indonesians, the Indians, that will fill a void of trade and fill a void of goods. You know, there was a very controversial rice scheme in Thailand with the prior administration under Yingluck, where basically they had hoped to impact the rice market globally and withheld some of the stocks from it. And, you know, the void was filled by other producers
who just backfired entirely.
It backfired entirely, and I'm not making a political statement here, I'm making an economic statement, and that as a result, other people filled the void. So, you know, you can decide not to trade with other people. It doesn't mean they're going to stop trading. They'll just pick other people to trade with. Then you say, well, they don't have the capacity. They may develop the capacity, or they may increase the capacity, because when there's a void and an opportunity, people will fill it. So, you know, it's not just a worry about the impact on the Asian economies, it's a worry about the impact ultimately on America and whether it de facto gives up its role in trade and whether it cedes an opportunity to others. Because again, it's a very competitive world. It's a very flat world.
I think this is it's a wait and see now. So there's a lot of changes that are coming, and we'll hope for the best. Asia continues to roll on, and with that, I know you got to roll on. You've got a flight to catch, and I really appreciate your time. It's great visiting with you, Ken.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Kent Wertheim, co-CEO of Ogilvy & Mather Asia Pacific and author of Digimarketing, the Essential Guide to New Marketing and Digital Media. For more information and for a link to the extraordinary story of the woman who stayed on the loudspeaker throughout the tsunami and lost her life in the process, head to www.insideasiapodcast.com. As listeners know, we tend to end things with a little bungkus. It's an Indonesian term for a takeaway meal and our way of wrapping up the best parts from our guest interviews and leaving you with food for thought. Each week, I get on the phone with our producer, Steve Hayward, and we talk things through. This week, it seems all a little surreal. I kid you not that as I sit here in our Bali home, another tremor just ran beneath the house. There have been 300 of these jolts in the last 24 hours and likely more to come. The ceiling lamps are still swaying and the birds outside have gone dead silent. In a world increasingly shaped and controlled to our will through the application of new technologies and creature comforts, coming in close contact with the power of nature is an oddly disturbing thing. Like my friend who described rippling pavement during the Tokyo earthquake, it bends the mind to witness these natural occurrences. There was a time not so long ago when all of us lived in close proximity to nature. It was something to be admired and feared. Urbanization has been on a tear these past 50 years. As of 2014, more people around the world lived in cities than did not, and by 2050, a whopping 70% will be urbanites. In air-conditioned high-rises, clutching our always-on mobile devices, we feel insulated, secure, in control. I watched earlier today footage from the 2011 tsunami. People strolled and gazed from the cement-reinforced bank of the river as the waters rose precariously. Despite the calls to take to higher ground, people remained transfixed, looking down with calm curiosity on the torrent of moving water. Only when the river breached the walls did panic set in. I can hear just outside the village boys playing football. The evening air is still. There's a calm all around, just another day in paradise. Even the tremors are starting to go unnoticed. Further up the road, young people are gathered in traditional dress. They're playing instruments, singing, and holding out boxes for donations. The boxes say, "Pray for Agung." They're smiling and laughing, but here's the thing. The Balinese know something that city dwellers don't know. Nature can't be controlled or harnessed. Nature will do what nature does. The Balinese have another technology, and it goes by the name of ritual. For the Balinese, appeasing the gods through song, chants, and prayers seems as good a plan as any when confronted with the forces of nature. So send Bali your prayers, and let's hope Agung is listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.
Inside Asia is produced in partnership with 1880, a members club in Robertson Quay, in the heart of downtown Singapore. Born out of the idea that conversations can and will make the world a better place, 1880 offers a space in which diverse minds gather and great ideas bloom. For more information or to inquire about membership, visit www.1880.com.sg.